Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name's Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith. And today we are joined by founding principal of Muse Community Design, Courtney Kashima.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. It's our pleasure.
How are you today?
Well, when the sun's shining, hard to be anything but happy.
I know. That's something that we were just talking about this. That snowfall. So for people listening, I think this episode's going to go up on today's Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Today's Thursday. This episode's going up on Saturday. So Wednesday, yesterday, for us, was that day of snow. It might have snowed again by the time Saturday comes around. Who knows?
I hope not.
It's gorgeous out today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
We were in Milwaukee last night, and it snowed like 7-8 inches, and then it already was like mostly melting by the time we left today at noon.
So it snowed to inconvenience us and is now gone.
Yep. Yep.
And you'd like to think you're not the person that talks about the weather, but given what we've been through, you can't help it.
It's really hard because I feel like I want to be able to just go up to everyone I know and be like, we're going through like a 4th, 5th winter. It's like the middle of April. It's like weirdly depressing. Like, we're here in this together, you know?
A hardy breed in Chicago, I would say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I like to pride myself on not being, it's like you said, I like to pride myself on not being a small talk person. But like, how can we not talk about the weather? It is ridiculous.
Well, and I really am a winter person, and I'm just devastated by this. It's like exhausting. Well, today is really nice. Today's been really great. But like yesterday, I was like, how would you do anything in this weather? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, we're really glad to have you here. We were introduced to you by Vitaly Vladimirov, who we've had on the show in the past. And he highly recommended your urban planning work, and we love talking about urban planning. I don't know where do you want to start? Well, how about this? Before we started recording, you kind of started talking a little bit about your background and that you come from a small town and that you moved to a big city. And I'm always interested in that conceptually, because I think that, especially now politically, that mindset,
that divide.
You know, the rural versus the urban is something that I think when we'll find success in bridging that gap, I think. But it's hard, you know, and I'm curious for you, what from that background, what brought you to urban planning work?
Yeah, so I was in high school when my stepfather was appointed to fill a vacancy on the city council in my hometown of Galesburg, Illinois, which some people might know. They usually either know because of Knox College, Carl Sandburg, or there's a medium security prison there. So,
that's a wide spectrum.
Or maybe not. You know, depends.
A friend of mine from high school went to Knox, and that's a really cool like liberal arts hub.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of those kind of quintessential liberal arts colleges. Growing up there, you don't always feel it. It doesn't necessarily penetrate out into the community, but then you do something like go to a college for kids in the summer, and that's a way to connect with what's going on there. But Galesburg has still brick streets, a lot of charm, like Victorian homes. It's a railroad town, both freight and passenger, so that's kind of, I don't know, a vibe when you arrive. I mean, we joke that you can't rob a bank because you'd get stopped by a train on the way out. You just couldn't make it. But it was, you know, of course, you kind of hate where you grow up, and now I appreciate it. But he was appointed to fill a city council vacancy, and it really opened my eyes to, wow, the government can tell you how high your fence can be. And there was a controversial housing development proposal next to our neighborhood, and he voted his conscience, which made him unpopular with a lot of our neighbors and people we thought that were our friends, sort of a classic NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it really just, like I said, opened my eyes to the processes, the politics, how decisions get made about the built environment. I didn't know that language yet, but I was already on my way to U of I as an art major, actually, and after my first semester, switched to urban planning because it just called to me as something I wanted to dedicate my life to, basically. So I'm what they call a plan nerd.
Cool. This is the thing, and you may not know of this thing, but there's something I always love talking about on the show, which is that Facebook group, New Urbanist Memes for Public Transit Oriented. You know, are you familiar?
NumTots.
Oh, this is amazing. Yeah. Well, because you mentioned NIMBYism, and I was like, that is like a cornerstone of that. I know nothing about urban planning. I joined that group because I live in a city, and I joined it like 2 years ago, I think, or a year and a half ago, maybe. And I feel like I'm always so impressed by when you can translate things through internet culture. Like and obviously I don't think that everyone that is in that is a numtot is an urban planning expert. But I guess I'm now that I've never met an urban planning person that is also like intimately. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but what. All right, I'm just going to ask the question I want to ask, what's your thoughts on that existence, on like seeing something that you've studied be made into meme culture?
I mean, that's the only way forward. Yeah. I think it's amazing because no one ever knows what urban planning is. I mean, at every cocktail party, I'm prepared to, you know, for the question, what do you do? And then there's sort of a two-beat pause and a look on their face, and they're like, what is that? Even my neighbors and some of my family members over years, I have to keep explaining it. And I love people's reaction to, like, once they get it, you can see the gears cranking. I also love people's guesses at what it is.
Sure.
For example, my neighbor was like, so you don't plant the trees, but you tell people where to plant the trees. And this is after several conversations, but I tease her that she sells widgets, so I think it's okay. Like,
yeah.
We don't all have to understand. But obviously, because I'm passionate about the subject and I think about it day and night, and it does affect everyone's life, I do wish people understood it and they're like kind of step into their power so that quality of life improves and, you know, our shared assets are reflective of our values. So if it needs to be distilled down to a meme, I'm fine with that. And I mean, it's funny too, so.
Right. Well, and I'm going to tie this back into kind of how we got here, which is I love how dedicated the space is to not just talking about New York public transit, you know? I love that it's about like, oh, well, what other cities, what do you think about their transit? You know, what ties transit together? There are so many of these railroad towns, you know, that exist throughout, because it's the way that we laid rail was so tied into building a national experience, you know, and I think that is something that can be lost upon like the people at large. And I guess, yeah. Ooh, I don't have a question though. This happens sometimes where I get like so excited by the thing we're talking about.
No, you're totally fine. So I want to talk about Muse Community Design. So you are the founding principal of this firm. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how long it's been around, like kind of what your mission is in this community design firm. Yeah, like tell us about Muse.
Sure. So my entire career has been in urban planning, and I've worked on the public side, the private side, and the not-for-profit side, kind of doing neighborhood-level economic development. So I've kind of done it all. And I think as a baseline, I consider myself kind of entrepreneurial. So I've always been thinking like, well, I could do this better, or here's how I would build a firm. So I am on a mission to build a better firm in terms of the processes we develop, the plans we deliver, and as a place to work, because I've worked some places that weren't great, and I want to achieve both sides of them. So the firm is 3.5 years old, and it's kind of like the little engine that could. It's quite humble, but this year kind of turned a corner with a major contract with the Chicago Department of Transportation. So it's like the growth I've been waiting for, but also keeps me up at night because you have to figure out every aspect of not only running a business, but now I'm an employer. And I think we have a very narrow view of what startups look like. So I'm interested in expanding that too. Like, you don't have to wear a hoodie and jeans and be in Silicon Valley.
Right.
I think I get dismissed because I have young children and I'm a woman. And so people kind of put me in this box or make up ideas about what I'm doing. And so I'm really on a mission to evolve the planning field through our work and also create like a great place to work.
Well, so that's super interesting to me because I know there's something about creating something that is another experience. You know, I think that in a lot of ways, we live in a society that wants to be able to go like, oh, you do this and it's this thing. But as soon as someone puts you into that kind of other box, there's also weirdly kind of a, it comes at a cost, obviously, but there's a freedom that also comes where you go like, oh, well, I can build something different. You know, so for you, kind of what has there been moments like that where you've been like, this is something I recognize that's wrong with either, you know, the startup model generally or in the urban planning space? Like, what are the things that you've kind of made your tenets?
Yeah. First of all, I feel like I'm doing it in a really honest way. Some people launch a firm by stealing a few clients from their old firm. And I mean, I guess more power to them. But it really is from the ground up building something. And so it is a labor of love and it's hard. There's those days where I want to pull my hair out and be like, what was I thinking? Mm-hmm. But I really love the freedom and the autonomy exactly the way you're describing, that I can make decisions, do what I think is right, you know, blog about what I want to blog about, incorporate ideas and new ways of doing things without having to check with anyone else. And that's really liberating.
Well, yeah. And so this is actually super interesting and relevant to a lot of the things that we think about because it's an interesting thought, right? Because, you know, when you start something and it grows and you go, okay, now we're starting to be able to affect things on a level that we didn't think about when we first started. And when you're able to kind of start thinking about what next steps I'm trying to think of, I guess I'm just going to keep using what I'm saying, which is these like next levels. There's also kind of that game of, well, there's already a lot of like pre-existing structures that you, it's something that we talk a lot about with artistic folks, which is the idea of when you've been trained in a traditional art form, it can feel like you want to bring the best of that to what you're doing, but you also want to be doing something different, but you also don't want to shun people that are those traditionalist mindset but then also be able to let them recognize that different thing that you're doing is ultimately better for everything. So all of this being said, have you found that that's a space that you need to navigate, and have you had like successes and challenges in navigating that kind of dichotomy?
I definitely relate to that. I was having a conversation with someone recently because there's the work I've done and there's the work I want to do. And on top of that right now, there's the work I happen to be winning. So if I ever had a bumper sticker, it would say, don't believe everything you think. And I really try to stay true to that because in this example, I know what I want to do. I haven't been hired for that yet. And I might make a pivot with my firm to align with the work I am, have been successful at winning. And so it is just that stopping, lifting your head up, being like, wait a minute, is this okay? Instead of giving into the inertia or just following along. So I relate to that very much. Like, for example, I'm not a transportation planner, but I've been most successful at winning transportation work where I'm the sort of land use, zoning, community engagement piece of that. And so, you know, the next thing I might do on my website and my promotional materials is start to talk about mobility as a service line, because I'm not going to start designing bike lanes. I don't have the training nor the interest. I'm glad there's people that do. But that mobility piece, getting people around, understanding when transportation projects are undertaken, how you make it relevant and contextually appropriate, is something I know how to do, am good at, and enjoy. So that's an example of how I'm dealing with that issue.
Sure. Wow.
Spin seems to be like a good, like when you're not being given it like exactly what you think you should be doing, being like, okay, that's fine. Like, I'll get this done, and I'll do a great job, and I'll do my best. And, you know, maybe I'll continue to, you know, in your case, win contracts like that. But, like, yeah, taking that and being like, all right, but how do I skew this to what I'm really interested in? And
or even, you know, I think that harkening back to what we were talking about, that being when you're put in that other space, you also start sympathizing and recognizing other people that have been put in that other space. And I think that when you're in that place, you start realizing that there are ways to do things that are like more inclusive, ultimately more accessible, that are better. And then especially you start applying the things that you may perceive as like traditional mindsets that really apply to that other mindset. But that's yeah, I want, is it like a, do you find it's a translation thing? Like, do you have to translate into as you're entering kind of like thinking about winning contracts, like is that kind of that more like traditional space, and there do you have to like parse what your interests are, or do people seem to like be open to change?
I mean, that's really a big issue I've been facing, where people are really scared of different or new, and mm-hmm. it's a huge barrier for me. You know, I have nearly 20 years of experience in the field. I'm a leader in like the professional association at different levels. So I'm not an unknown quantity, but I still have trouble because it's under what I call a new flag. So they know me, but they don't know my firm because it's new, and it's a huge barrier, and I just don't understand it. It's not logical or rational, but it's very much a thing. So I try to focus on differentiators, like some unique aspects, giving more than maybe my competitors might. The issue I have is you'll have an organization. A lot of my work is competitively bid. So an organization will put out an RFP with all this language, but they don't actually mean it. Or they may have a bunch of value statements in their mission about equity and this and that. And I know I've put forward the best proposal and the best team, and they still go with what they know, which is typically mm-hmm. the established white male-owned firms. And I don't think this is just sour grapes. I mean, I have enough self-awareness to know what's going on. And that's what bothers me, is if you're saying one thing and hiring in another way, I have a problem with that.
That is so deeply reflected in the arts community in Chicago, where a lot of organizations, a lot of like well-meaning artists, well-intentioned artists will talk a lot about accessibility. We'll talk a lot about, like, you know, we need to open this up to other communities. But, like, it's at the end of the day, like, it's not reflected in how they function. It's like deep down, like, they are still very much operating in a very traditional way. Like, their board of directors will be white men. Their ticket prices won't be accessible. Their ticket prices will be high to the point of alienating the community that they operate in, you know, charging $40, $50 for a ticket when you say that your company is grassroots. It's like there's that dissonance there of like, yeah, that's such a frustrating like obstacle. Because that's what it is.
The listeners can't see that my head's about to nod off in agreement. Because, yes, the dissonance really bothers me. It's like, not to rely on cliches, but like, you got to talk the talk and walk the walk.
Yeah.
And people just want to shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, as if they don't know how to do it. And it's not actually that hard. Someone just has to give a shit and lift their head up and think a little bit differently and make it happen. I mean, especially because I deal with bureaucracies all the time. So that's like the worst of the worst in this regard.
Ugh. Well, and this is such a great conversation. The first thing I want to say, and this isn't leading, I eventually have something to say that leads to a question, I promise. But the first thing I want to say is I love finding out about other spaces and interests that are that do kind of fall into this other category. Like recently I've always loved like cartoons and stuff, but recently I just covered C2E2 and I'd never even been to a nerd conference before, and it was amazing to realize that so many of these interests really they're the same kind of person, you know, like the same, like the folks that I've met that are really passionate about urban planning are passionate about inclusiveness and about accessibility and all these things in the same way that the people that are making good grassroots art are, you know. And I think that in a lot of ways we separate into like the things that we're interested in and think that the people that are interested in, like the nerds of a different cloth are nerds of a different cloth. But in reality, like we're all just trying to,
we have the same values, we have right. the same, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's a fun, that's a really fun, thing to kind of, discover and understand. And I think that's kind of, you know, what I'm so interested about with, specifically the urban space, is I feel like that can be such a, platform for collaboration and coalition building. And I especially think that as we kind of like, that's something we were talking about before we started recording, but is that idea of like public space versus private space. You know, I think that there's really, and it's super interesting because like for a long time I've also like really appreciate and the entrepreneurial spirit is really important to me. But I wonder with, and especially with folks that are making their own things now, I think there's a call in 2018 for figuring out what collaboration looks like for individuals. You know, we talk about this sometimes in the show, where it's like, if you're growing a thing, if you're trying to go that step above what an individual can do, and you're saying like, okay, I want to build a platform, right? Like for us especially, that's something we think about, where it's like, if we're building a platform, what is it that we're trying to accomplish that like Maureen, the singer, social media person, like things that you're good at individually, Daniel, the digital media individual things, like what is it that multiple people coming together to build a thing can do? And there's kind of like two facets to the question that I'm working to build towards to ask you, which is the one that I'm curious for you. Are there things like related to the public versus private conversation that tie into that in so much that are there ways in which private entities can like stand in the way of collaboration? And I also am curious for you as a private urban planning firm, what are the ways in which you work to like collaborate, or how do you want to see that happen? And I don't necessarily mean like collaborate in the traditional sense, but like that kind of like thinking about it more of like when you are working with and bringing on individuals.
Yeah, and I've told some people that Muse is a movement disguised as a consulting firm.
Cool.
So that's my outlook. And a lot of times it really is about philosophy and outlook and just the way you approach things. So when I think about public versus private space, I'm always surprised. I think people think things happen by accident, or think they happen and there's no, you might not have a say as a neighbor or a resident. And it's just not true. Now, on the one hand, who has time to go to 8,000 meetings? You probably don't. But there's a lot of points in the process. Say, for example, a new development is coming to your neighborhood and there's something about it that just really isn't appropriate. There's a lot of points where you could or should have a say. So on the one hand, I would ask people again to kind of step into that power and learn how decisions get made. In Chicago, you know, it's largely at the alderman level. We basically have 50 small cities here in the city of Chicago, which is not the way it's done everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's attending a march, showing up and speaking at a meeting, or calling for a community meeting, there are those opportunities. It just sometimes doesn't feel like it, or it's such an unfamiliar space that it can be intimidating to people. I will say the development process is a lot of theater. So I'll say you have power and can exert it. But on the other hand, there's a lot of going through the motions and in very formal ways, like attending a zoning board of appeals hearing or a plan commission meeting. But also, even if a community meeting is called, you know, honestly, a lot of times it's just for the production value. So I think, like a lot of things that are political in nature, if people got together and sort of were able to rise up, there are opportunities to make a difference. People just have to be aware of it and then actually act.
Do you know of the apartment complex, I guess, chain Flats?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I'm about to shit on Flats, so I don't know what your view on it is, but I'm gonna shit on it. But it's like these high end apartment complexes that absolutely put up this front of like collaboration and like wanting to be involved in the community, but their apartments are prohibitively expensive, and in reality, they don't want to work with people. Like artists that we've known have like reached out to them, and like they don't want to play ball most of the time unless it's entirely on their terms. And it's like, and they keep popping up in these neighborhoods. Like there's one in Uptown, like right on Lawrence, like right off the Lawrence Red Line stop, which is like an economically depressed area. And it's like, this and things like this pop up, like it does seem overwhelming. Like I think that there's a Flats opening up like on like Broadway and Foster area, and it's like that's going to impact the price of our rent, and it seems overwhelming and like scary. But like, yeah, I think it's important that people do know that, like, there are things you can do. Like, there are these community meetings. And, like, in the case of the Flats going up, I think that there's, like, I think that that's, like, going
to
happen. But, like,
to your point, the thing that I was going to kind of talk about is one of the things you brought up is organizing locally. And I think that in a lot of ways, it can really, we get so, I think, with in 2018 specifically, and I think that there's a lot of good reasons for this. You know, I think that the way that the 2016 election went, a lot of people were activated to political action, which is fantastic. But I think that in a lot of ways, short of that vote, there's not much that we can do on a national level in 2017 and 2018, besides obviously other votes and voicing opinions and donating. And there are a lot of things we can do. What I mean to really say is that there are a lot. Yeah, what I'm more getting to is that there are cases though where local, in as far as like progressive, what some may call like extreme policy, like rent control is the thing I'm thinking of, and the thing that you were bringing up, like that. I now off the top of my head, I don't entirely remember which neighborhood it was, but there was a few neighborhoods that had on their ballot for the recent election about rent control, and it passed. And I think that is something that could, for some people, may be a really like extreme radical position. But why? And also, that vote reached more ears, even though it was a local or a more local space. Like that seemed to, like there were. I'm wondering if where I saw that it was. But anyway, I guess. Oh man, I don't have a question. What is up with me today?
So you mentioned the importance, but also kind of like the kind of two sides of getting involved on the local level in development. And, something that I know that we talked about before this is kind of like the lack of communication, the lack of collaboration between developers. And I know that you deal a lot in equality in urban planning. I'm wondering if you could speak to kind of your view of the importance of equality as cities develop.
Sure. I think the first thing is to be intentional with language. So people might use equality and equity interchangeably, but they're two very different ideas. And this is something I've been educated on more recently, where equality means giving everyone the same thing. That's usually not what we need. Where equity means giving the most to the people who need it the most. That's really the idea. So not to like spar over
words. No, I appreciate that.
But it's a shift I've made as I've learned about it. And I think it's so powerful and so important to like connect with that, the difference there. I wanted to step back for 1 second. So I think it's important to always have your eyes and ears open. So when you mentioned that the flats present themselves as very community-minded, think about how the ideas of community and neighborhood have been completely co-opted. And I'm not familiar enough with the flats to say this is what they're doing, but I will pick on, for example, Applebee's. Their tagline is something like neighborhood bar and grill. Have you ever seen an Applebee's in an actual neighborhood? No. They're next to the highway. They're in some godforsaken sea of asphalt. But that obviously is a touch point for people. Mm-hmm. They want to believe that Applebee's is their neighborhood bar and grill, even though they can't walk there. They won't know anyone in there, you know. And like Panera does this. A lot of companies do it. So obviously those marketing geniuses have tapped into something inside of folks. And developers do it too. So that's what I try to be like a good consumer of the world, I guess, and be mindful of when I'm being marketed to in very subtle ways. So that's one comment I wanted to make.
Yeah.
With my renewed commitment to equity and inclusion, I do feel called to urban planning, and I do believe it affects everyone's life, and I want to do it better. So the way I'm trying to do that is the projects I pursue, the processes we develop to work with communities. And then back to this idea of walking the walk. Even though I'm a struggling business, I try to make donations to organizations that need it. I'm switching up like where I spend my money, who I hire, trying to convince other people that who they hire, me, you know, hopefully me, matters. Because planning is a field deeply in need of disruption. It's very stuck in old ways. And when the decision makers are predominantly of a certain, you know, demographic, things aren't going to change. So there's sort of at every level things that need to happen in planning. And I see the decision makers changing. And I think that's going to be good for me. As people retire, an older generation is done. Women, for example, are getting into positions of power. I think they're going to like what I have to say. We're going to have shared values about the right way to engage a community and make decisions about a community. And I'm here ready to provide it, basically.
Well, and I think that that finally ties into kind of what I was trying to get to, which is that I think in a lot of ways there really is a shift happening. And it feels... I guess what my ultimate question is this just me being hopeful, or does it feel like those bigger chunks of people, the people that may have power or that may, be the way that things are done, it feels like there's a call for change in some way. And it does feel like that there are people looking to find people that are willing to be that. This is a decision to make. You know what I mean? Like, people are willing to look at the local level to be like, okay, what's some good ideas? What's the upstart? What's the small firm doing something different? You know, is that us just being hopeful as those kind of other people that have always kind of been pushed to the boundaries, or are we entering a space where maybe those boundaries are brought to the forefront? Do you think that, or?
Yeah, and a good friend shared this with me. He said, equity is a freight train, and I just can't let go of that idea because I'd like to be on the freight train, not get run over by it. And so that's one way of answering your question. Should we be hopeful or just give up? Because we all go up and down, you know, depending on what we wake up to. Is this a hopeful kind of day, or, you know, or just want to throw in the towel? But I am hopeful, from statues coming down to... I mean, here's kind of a tiny example. When Black Panther came out, in 1 weekend, I had to explain twice to some non-Black friends why it was such a big deal. And I could have been snarky and bitchy and, you know, sighed and rolled my eyes like, I can't believe I even have to explain this. But it's kind of my job to do that if someone doesn't understand it. And it's so things like Black Panther, I guess I'd rather focus on all of the things, the changes I do see. And everyone else should know we're coming for you, basically.
Right.
With the equity freight train.
Yeah.
I love the conversations around the, like, Wakanda urban planning thing. Mm-hmm. Is that, do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I think it's, I've even pitched it. I responded to an RFP recently where, as a way to engage youth, create an exercise that would incorporate Wakanda and urban planning. Now, here's an example of what I try to do differently. So I am white, and in this is a community that is not majority white. And so I would want that process to be led, and had proposed it be led, by people who aren't white. Because if I just come in and do it, then I'm sort of only half walking the walk. But all kinds of kids connect to Black Panther. And I think it's an amazing way along these lines of, like, do I mind things getting distilled down to memes? No, because if it's accessible and relatable, then, you know, we've done our jobs.
That's amazing. And it's something that I think, not to like toot our own horn, but kind of like backing up my theory that I'm now, I guess, working on this week, which is this idea of, I think there's an undercurrent of theory and thought that's going around on in marginalized, in different, what have been separated marginalized folks, because I know that's, a couple organizations that are trying to think that way. And something that we've been working on in the last year and a half with, we have one thing that we come from opera. And opera is a traditionally white field. There was a bunch of organizations recently that kind of charted out the programming of major opera companies. And it's, you know, every conductor they hire is white and male. Every composer, obviously, because it's European, and so it's Eurocentric, and all the composers are white and male because Europe's always been patriarchal.
All the composers that are being programmed at major houses, like, not all of the composers are actually white and male.
Right.
Many
no,
of
no,
them
no.
Are,
right, yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. what I'm ultimately getting to, though, is that idea of we talk about it in the lens of artistic licensure. So when it comes to like programming a recital, and we're like, okay, we want to do. So a lot of companies will be like, oh, we want to do a Black concert, or we want to do a Latinx concert, or whatever, and they will then, you know, program the Black work. You know, they'll program, like, Porgy and Bess is a great example. Mm-hmm. For those not familiar, that is, it's like a almost musical, almost opera that is written by a white man that is about Black people. And it's honestly, like, pretty super stereotypical. I mean, if there are Black folks that, like, love Porgy and Bess, cool. Like, but I've also heard other sides. I've heard both sides from folks that that both love it and both hate it. But ultimately what I'm saying is it's a really easy thing for a white organization to be like, oh, we'll just program this, you know? But there's a wealth of material that's written, that's classical in scope, that's like even fits traditional standards, that's written by Black folks, that's written by Central American folks, South American folks,
that are contemporaries,
Filipino folks,
that are contemporaries with the heavy hitters in classical music. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a composer out there who's called the Black Mozart, mm-hmm. who, like, was this a Black composer who wrote at the same time as Mozart, but Mozart, because he's white, was a bigger deal. And so
the world of this preface is because, and I actually do have a question this time, is because yes. I'm very curious, like, when we talk about artistic licensure and making sure to, so my point being here is that the thing that we then try to make sure to do is when we're like, okay, we're going to do, we have this series called Hearing in Color. And so when we started it, we were like, okay, we don't want to have any hand in the programming. We don't want to make any of the decisions. We want to reach out to someone and go, like, we're going to pay the pianist. We're going to find you a venue. We're going to do all of the, like logistical things that don't need
the
artistic.
Shitty legwork.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious for you, for how I know exactly what the question is. I'm just trying to figure out how to verbalize it. And it actually has that super, the reason why I'm continuing to bring this up is because it super has to do with the question I'm asking you, which is how do you, so if our audience, for example, aren't familiar with urban planning, but are familiar with that concept, how do you translate the things that you have to do to people that don't know urban planning?
Sure. I got it right away. Cool. For me, I call it check the box syndrome. Mm. It's like, so when I hear you say, oh, it's time to do a Black concert series or it's Black History Month, what are we going to do? And they resort to the same, return to the same thing over and over again. It's like this check the box mentality. Right. Like, oh, did it. And that's, we can just wipe our hands. And then there's, of course, like a usual suspects issue. Like, again, no one wants to lift their head and be like, well, I know we always go to so-and-so, but guess what? There's 10, 20, 100 more so-and-sos. So let's not just keep repeating the same things and expecting a different result. It's so important, especially, I mean, each of our work, if you think of, in the case of music, there's a community, a public piece, something that's bigger than just the people directly involved. And certainly in urban planning, we're affecting communities. And so we have a responsibility to do better. And so I'm fighting that mentality every day.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Are there things that you found that work to do that? Or is it still really kind of, cause that's, I got to imagine that's like a whole, like what works in trying to combat the, like, I mean, development, it seems like development without displacement has been the status quo for a long time. I mean, development with, I'm sorry, what I mean is that the idea of gentrification, like the idea of displacement, is like intrinsic in the way we have developed.
And it's slapped as progress.
Right, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, are there things that we're finding work?
I haven't cracked it yet. That's the mission I'm on. I will say, though, I continually try to educate people around that whole, like, are your values being reflected in your decisions? And I'm sure urban planning and the arts community share this. Like, where's the money?
Right.
Like, if this is what you value, pay us. And even in my daily life, like in the old Facebook neighborhood group, I'm so tired of seeing, anybody know a cheap painter, a cheap plumber, a cheap designer? It's like, not to sound like I'm starting a revolution, but like, let's worry about the CEOs and quit. I mean, the plumbers and the house painters aren't the problem. So it's like, we don't value the things that we should. I mean, the arts are clearly underfunded. When I respond to an RFP and it's $150,000 worth of work, but they've only budgeted $55,000, it's like I have this internal monologue of, well, on the one hand, this is important and I know I'd do it better and more contextually appropriate and want to win the work, but am I going to sell myself short by, you know?
That's something that we face a lot, where it's like, and it's gotten, and because the arts are so chronically underfunded, artists, there are a couple ways that artists approach a low offer, where they either are insulted and don't take it, which I'll say right up front, every approach to a lowball offer is legitimate, because, you know, you can do, anyone can do whatever they want. So some people will be insulted by a low offer and they'll walk away. For the love of man.
Dog and cat. cat antics.
So or they'll try to negotiate and, like, you know, or they'll take it and be resentful of it. Or they'll take it and then rationalize it of like, well, it's not feeding my wallet, but it's feeding my soul. And then they'll, like, really put a lot into it and try to get the most out of the experience, not really think about the money and just be like, I'm doing what I love, blah, blah, blah. Or they'll just decide that they are not going to make their money from the arts and they just do something else and then do the arts because they enjoy it. And if they make money, then fine. And it's like the fact that there are so many rationalizations and decisions that artists have to go through just because they're not getting paid enough. It's like everybody spends so much time and effort and money on this training, like, mm-hmm. and it sucks that there's no question,
to your point, the idea, all of that is to combat this thing that we've had imposed on us of not talking about money. And I think that's super powerful that you're willing to do that. And I think that, I know where I'm going with this, which is like, how do you do that? But also, like, is there, what, do you have moments where you feel like, how do you broach these conversations? Like, what, and also, like, what is the like culture that allows these conversations to not be broached? I mean, like, the idea of not talking about, I mean, for artists, it's something that I'm finding myself bringing up to artists a lot, which is, we should be talking about how much we're getting paid, especially even on the small scale, where it's like, I know a lot of people that are doing grassroots opera things and are making the difference between the soprano lead and the baritone lead are hundreds of dollars because the baritone lead's a man, and so there are less men in opera, and so that person's paid more. But it's not talked about, you know, and that's an issue because then you don't know what the budgeting of the major opera company looks like. And we're constantly just like fleshing out these things to you because I think that it's amazing to get to talk with you about this because a lot of things that you're saying seem very relevant to that. And so I want to both give you as much information as possible and figure out how to learn more about like those levels of so like what, what do you ends up being kind of your like stump speech, I guess? Like, what is the thing that you end up making sure to drive home when you're in conversation with people that are kind of doing the status quo kind of thing?
Yeah, because I should mention a big difference between, let's say, the arts community and urban planning is we have this layer of government, right? So right. There's rarely an urban planning effort that isn't at least tangentially tied to the government, and that brings its own, I don't know, associations and baggage and things. So, for example, especially in the post-recession, some communities were getting rid of their urban planning department altogether, which is shocking and horrible to someone like myself. But it's a way to see that people don't value it. They see planning, the function of planning, is more like paper pusher or someone keeping the process moving, where really some of your favorite places in the world did not happen by accident, you know, whether it's a place in Europe or South America or even a cute little town, Asheville, you know, whatever, Galena, those don't just happen by accident. There's a series of decisions made and decision makers involved. And that's what I want to remind people, like the value of planning, I guess.
Right.
And there's a bill in the House, the state legislature, they want to get rid of any public dollars spent on continuing ed. Now, I think what's in their mind is they heard about someone going to Las Vegas on some sort of junket. But I'm horrified at the thought, like, would you ever hire an attorney or a doctor who has had no continuing ed? But we're saying that we don't want our public servants to ever have continuing ed. It's just a ridiculous idea. But government bears a lot of the brunt of things like that because, you know, it's like, oh, government, and they're wasteful and they're inefficient. So that adds a layer of complexity mm-hmm. in the urban planning space of like not valuing the work. It also becomes heavily politicized, where in a perfect world, it shouldn't be, you know, like mm-hmm. a department of transportation or a planning department. They are professionals who should make recommendations to elected or appointed decision makers, but it gets all messy. And that's a lot of, we see the results of that and usually don't like it because it's politicized, but no one really wants to acknowledge it.
When there's a changeover in government, like if you know, an elected official is voted out and replaced, have there been instances of like cleaning house, like in the trans, I mean, I know on a national level there have been, you know, with cabinet changes and stuff like that, but on a local level, have like, you know, mid-level employees within those departments been cleared out with, like, I guess I hate, you know, regime change seems intense, but I guess regime changes,
probably not mid-level, but definitely like a commissioner of a department, yeah, is likely to change. And then there's things people don't think about at all, like, is it an election year? Like, things may have mysteriously stopped happening in your neighborhood, and you as a just a resident wouldn't be like, oh yeah, it's an election year, so we're only going to talk about non-controversial stuff, we're not going to move anything forward. Like, how terrible a reality that is, that right. Things don't get moved forward because it's quote unquote an election year.
I'm curious, there's been a lot of construction in our neighborhood, and it's been going on for the past 2 years, and I'm curious, and so like our water gets shut off a lot and blah blah blah, but I'm curious, next year is the aldermanic race for our district, and I'm curious to see if that construction,
you don't,
just
you
stop.
Don't realize you're in a quote unquote election year,
yeah,
right now, because that will happen in February, and so right now you're in an election year.
Yeah.
Wow. Another thing I kind of am really curious about, and I, there's a relevancy here to what you've already been saying, but I'm gonna not remember it. So what I am thinking about a lot lately is the idea of thinking about audience, right? And thinking about the people that make up, and it ties into the idea of thinking about services versus thinking about commodities. And it relates to this idea of this mindset of thinking of people as consumers rather than people. And I'm curious how that relates to your work. Is that something that you come across? And is that something that, is that, do you know what I mean by that idea? Yeah.
I think so. And I think it happens especially to certain communities. So a fairly radical idea in the planning field is, okay, well, status quo is there's a grant opportunity. So someone at City Hall, and I'm just talking hypothetically, pursues the grant because it sounds good to them. And they think it needs to happen on the south side. So they write it up and they win it, and then they start doing something to the south side. The radical idea is, before you ever even apply for something, you make sure the community wants that. That mm-hmm. what is that their priority, instead of having a paternalistic, frankly, approach to planning. But that's how things are done. It's like, oh, well, we thought the grant sounded good, so we applied and we won it, and now we're going to do it. And maybe they eventually talk to the community, but they certainly aren't out with the frequency and the kind of sincerity that there should be.
That reminds me a lot of, so in December, we talked to the Southside Mural Project, and it's There are two men in charge of that. One of them is an urban planner.
Chris.
Yeah. And then the other one, nice, is a muralist.
Love that.
Yeah. And what was so interesting is, like, you know, as two people not involved in urban planning, and also two people who don't live on the south side, you know, we hear the thought, we hear the idea of Southside Mural Project and bringing murals to you know, to communities, to beautify these communities. And we're like, oh, how can there be anything bad about that? A huge part of that discussion were all of the things that could be bad about that. And it was such an eye-opening conversation, because it's like you said, you know, you think that, you know, oh, how could there be anything wrong with affecting change in a community that needs change, that quote-unquote needs change, when really, like, we have no idea what these communities need, unless we go and actually talk to them.
Yeah, and that radical idea of actually, I mean, and this is a really weird parallel. The first parallel I was going to make that's probably more relevant is to FDR and how he, like, I've mentioned this in the show so many times, like, actually talking to people. But have you seen, I almost dropped it again. Have you seen anything about the Mr. Rogers documentary?
No, I need to.
I don't know when it, I don't know if it already came out or not, but
I think it comes out like this summer or this fall or something.
Yeah, a lot of folks that I really deeply respect are talking a lot about it and thinking about Mr. Rogers generally. And then I started thinking about it, and it's just like that radical idea of talking to kids like they're people. And I think that's something that we're really missing right now. And I think that that idea of just being able to be like, I'm listening to you, and like, what is it that you, what is it that you actually need, I think is so powerful. And I think that hearing that that work is being done on like the urban planning level seems really powerful. How do you do that?
So last week I had the chance to attend Policy Links Equity Summit. So it's a national convening of about 4,000 people who either are doing equity work or interested. And it was so powerful and so inspiring because there was every discipline of people. And it's such a big endeavor. They only do it usually every 3 years. Last time it was in Los Angeles, and this time it happened to be in Chicago. But the theme, there's kind of two takeaways that I'd like to share. One is this idea of radical imagination, that really it's just sort of starting there, like thinking about things differently and doing things differently. It's a lot of the ideas we have, it's just having the courage to actually do them. And then the other big idea was what they've termed the curb cut effect. And I'm so fascinated. I was even walking around today looking at curb cuts and thinking about this. So if you think about your typical intersection and the sidewalk, and curb cuts were installed largely for the to be ADA compliant. But think about all the people that benefit from a curb cut, whether you're a UPS delivery person, whether you're a parent pushing a stroller, even just, skateboarding. A lot of people benefit from that, even though it was intended for a narrow segment of society. And so even just having a thought like that and latching onto it and letting it affect your work, I think can be so powerful. So really encourage people to think of examples where they can use this idea of the curb cut effect, that you may be trying to affect a certain group, but almost any endeavor you might undertake will benefit more people than you could imagine. So just, it's really just thinking differently, I guess.
Yeah, that just harkens back to the importance of listening, because, you know, no one really would think to sit down with a UPS driver and be like, what do you need? Like, and even if you were, like, that's such an abstract question of, like, he'd be like, what do you even, like, how, if you were to sit down with anybody and say, what is it, like, here's what I do, what is it you need? Like, that's such a huge question. And yeah, I think that the concept of just, like, taking, like, making changes that you know from, like, you know, whether it's, like, you know, making sure that something is ADA compliant, making sure that something, you know, making sure that something is, you know, food safe or something like that. You know, if you make sure
handicap accessible, something
that you're talking about ADA compliant.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sorry.
But it's like you never really know how it's going to impact, and yeah.
So the other idea along these lines is the traditional approach in planning is like, oh, we need to get stakeholders at the table. It's all about bringing them to the table, when really it should be, you should be so relevant and what you're doing so meaningful that you're invited to their table. Mm. And so that's another just mental shift that I think if we had more of, we would see very real differences in how communities change and how people are served.
What are some things that are happening in our city that you think would benefit from having an open-minded and equity-minded urban planner involved? Like, what are things that are happening that you think would benefit from that mindset?
I mean, I could go on and on and get and get like micro or macro, but I mean, affordable housing, which we've already touched on, or housing affordability, sorry. You know, even the term is sort of loaded, where really the technical definition of housing affordability is that everyone, whether you're a billionaire or, you know, a regular person, should not spend more than 30% of your income on housing. So there's lots of people that quote unquote affordable housing. It's not just some stereotype that people have made up in their minds. So housing affordability is a big one. Transportation is a big one. And you see, if you read Streets blog, for example, they usually have excellent discussions of the big issues. So Divi, another of these, it is like, sounds cool. What could be bad? How could this go wrong? But when it's rolled out in an inequitable way, and it largely benefits Northside, you know, white communities, which it did at first, that's a problem. Then the city sort of said, after responding to some advocates, whoa, wait a minute, you know, maybe we could do this better. They created the Divi for Everyone program, and they're really monitoring how Divi's rolled out. But it's easy. It's easy, for example, you can't just slap a bunch of Divi stations on the south side because the built form is different, just in terms of how closely are different amenities or places that people visit, like your house, are there jobs, are there schools, are those kinds of things. So it has to be done differently. It can't be like, oh, and that sort of reinforces this idea of equality versus equity. Equality would be like, oh, we're just going to plop them down without much thought. But these neighborhoods need hyper-local responses. They need to be contextually appropriate and not just sort of plop down from the city center, you know, without thought.
That's, yeah, that comes back to the artistic licensure thing for me, where it's like, that's, you need the people that live in that neighborhood to put them there. You know, that's where it comes from. Well, we've actually gone over, so sorry for keeping you so long. But this has been a really awesome conversation.
Damn, if you ever went over.
Yeah.
It's your first time.
Oh, no, we do.
No, but it's like, it didn't feel long.
We do. I think in the 200 episodes, we've gone over 15, 20 times.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's, yeah, they tend to be my favorite episodes, frankly. That's, you know, not to... Anyway, sorry. Let's wrap up. So the last thing we do with all of our guests is a one-minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes that can be something fairly obvious, like plugging a podcast that they do, or plugging a blog that they write, or letting people know how they can support a firm that they work for. But we also love hearing self-care media that you're consuming. So... or shout outs to other folks doing dope work. And that can be anything from movies, TV shows, books, or music.
Awesome. Well, I do happen to have a podcast that I host. It's called The People Behind the Plans, and it's produced by the American Planning Association.
Cool.
Fair warning, though, it's very planner centric. So if you're interested, I would check it out, because I do talk to people from across the field and across the country. But I check in with my book club friend, who's a neuroscientist, to make, because I believe it's accessible to non-planners, and she's my barometer for
cool.
that.
Cool. That's really rad, though.
But yeah, I'd say if you're interested in some of these equity topics, check out Policy Link. Locally, there's a movement called Equiticity, led by Obaye Reed. So for Chicago folks, I would check that out. And then just be more mindful of the things you consume. So I'm reading different books, like The New Jim Crow, and switching up the news I follow in my newsfeed and actually paying for the news. It's small changes like that that can make the difference. So I think those are the things I'd like to share with people.
Dope. Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first and most recommended is to head over to scopimag.com. That's our website. We spell that scapimag.com. We have all sorts of articles there. You can subscribe on there, and Maureen will tell you more about that in a bit. Otherwise, you can keep up with us on social media. On Facebook, we have a Facebook group called Sounding Board. It's a really dope space of people creating stuff in Chicago. If you can't find it by searching it, either send Maureen, myself, or the Facebook page a message. And our Facebook page, if you're looking for it, is under Scopy Magazine. We are also on Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram under Scopy Mag. Again, same way as spelled as the spelled the same way as the website. And you can find our podcast, Scopy Radio, and all the podcast places.
And as Daniel mentioned, subscribing is kind of the keyword that we're going with. If you head to our website and go to our subscribe page, you can subscribe to our WordPress blog. That is what hosts our website. That way you'll get an email every time that we post. Also, if you are interested in becoming a subscriber in the financial sense, it makes a big difference in our operating budget for folks who do choose to subscribe to the magazine. There are going to be some benefits rolled out to those subscribers, although everything that we publish on the site will remain free because that is hugely important. Additionally, subscribe to us on iTunes, you know, and there are going to be links on or wherever you listen to podcasts. There are links for iTunes on that subscribe page. And also, if you're interested in advertising, we have a really awesome platform. We get about 10 to 20,000 views a month, and our advertising rates start as low as $25 a month. So give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.